I loved A Trial. This was a book that I just, I read it in two sittings, interrupted by a few hours of sleep. I woke up the following morning and picked it up. And that's the kind of book that it just holds you, and you just want to find out what happens next. I would assume that a lot of the information that you got as the basis for Trial came out of Daddy's Girl when you were there.
Yeah, it was leftover research knowledge and stories and tales that I had been told by judges and lawyers in Houston. Got me hooked on continuing to write about the criminal justice system from the inside. You know, the part that you never read in the daily newspapers or the magazines. And so, as soon as I finished Daddy's Girl, I began work on Trial. And now that I've finished Trial, I've already got so much material left over and so many ideas bubbling in my head that I've begun yet another novel. But this one is not set in Texas. However, it is about criminal justice. This one's set in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to be my genre at the moment.
Yeah, I was fascinated by it. I love trial stories anyway.
Me too.
They're just absolutely gripping. And even a true trial story is fascinating because it deals with the gamut of emotions.
Right, and it's natural drama. There can be no more exciting confrontation than the courtroom scene between the witness and the lawyer who's trying to destroy that witness in an effort to either convict or acquit someone charged of murder. It's raw drama, and it's real. So,
well, let's tell me about the drama in Trial. We have a well-meaning attorney who himself runs afoul of the law, but has his client's best interest at heart, and comes across a series of murder. Well, you tell it. Tell it.
Well, what fascinated me and got me writing Trial was my awareness of the jungle of attorney-client privilege. As you know, when you tell something to your lawyer, that's like telling it to your priest. It's confidential. It is sacred. He cannot repeat it to anybody ever except with your permission. And I came up with the idea, which is embedded in Trial, what happens if a lawyer's client confesses to him that he or she has committed another murder? Or another crime, but in Trial it is another murder. That is privileged information, but what if that lawyer happens to be representing someone who is accused of that murder? And that's what happens in the book. And Warren Blackburn, the hero of the book, is on the rack because there's nothing he can do. He cannot reveal the secret that he knows, and yet he can't stand the thought that another man is going to get the death penalty for something he didn't do when he, the lawyer, knows who did it. So Trial is a story of what he does to overcome that horrible dilemma.
He does, however, find a way around it, doesn't he?
Yes, with my help.
The trial scenes have an awful lot of authenticity. The judge, the female judge, the name escapes me. What's her
Ruth
name?
Ruth Parker.
Ruth Parker, that's right. Boy, she mean. Have you run across judges like that?
Oh, yes, indeed. In fact, my the judge in Trial is based on a couple of judges that I know from somewhere else, not Houston. And my publishers were really worried about the possibilities of libel, even though it's fiction. And I had to make many changes in the text so that certain similarities were not so apparent. But I do know judges like that, male and female, people who should not be sitting up there on the bench. They are not emotionally fit for it. They're either nasty, vicious, vengeful, and all too often they're stupid. In Texas and in many states, the only qualification for a judgeship is that you belong to the current ruling political party and that you have held your law degree for 5 years. Then you can run for a judgeship. And as you can imagine, this results in a number of unqualified people sitting up there on the bench. And there's not a damn thing that anyone can do about it. They rule. You can try and recuse them, as they say in the law, ask them to retire themselves from a case, but you better have an excellent reason for it. Otherwise, they can do what they like. Scary.
It is scary. Ed, do you hear me? Do you hear that pounding? Is it coming on the tape? No? Okay. Here in New York, we've got judges. They're appointed, actually, here, and they shouldn't be sitting. I'm told that's not going on the tape.
How can it not be on the tape?
Yeah. Listen to that. Can't hear you, Ed. Well, I think we'll go on.
They seem to stop.
They're putting new wiring in or something.
They'll start again as soon as we start talking.
Absolutely. Where were we?
You were talking about New York judges.
The difference between the New York judges and the Texas judges is that they are appointed here and often have a recommendation from the bar. They're rated by the Bar Association. But once they're in, they do all sorts of bizarre things. There was one judge in Brooklyn where a prostitute was brought before him. She had no place to go, so what did he do? He took her home with him.
At least humane. And, you know, the system of appointments, while I believe it's better than elections, still is fraught with patronage. You do a favor for somebody who's done a favor for you in the past, and you give them a judgeship. Or you suddenly say, well, we don't have enough women judges or black judges or Hispanic judges, and you look around, you grab whoever's available, put them on the bench. I suspect that the only solution to this is have an appointment of judges by the bar, by a consensus of the bar, or by a good representative committee of lawyers who won't be influenced by patronage and by political favors owed. And there are good judges in Houston where trial is set, and there are good judges everywhere. But like any profession, there are good and bad. And I find that especially frightening. I've been down in Florida researching a new novel, and I've been hanging out in Jacksonville and Sarasota, and I find the same thing down there. Again, they're elected judges, and some of them are incompetent.
Well, the criminal justice system in the South has always been kind of shaky anyway, especially then in Texas. And the police department there at one time was thought to be one of the top two, three, or four worst police departments in the United States. They may have made some improvements. I think I understand now they're requiring a certain degree of college education now for police officers. So maybe it's improved.
Yeah,
but
I found nothing to criticize in the Houston Police Department. I was there. I thought they were competent and friendly and humane. And as a matter of fact,
when they're not beating up Mexicans and throwing them into bios.
No, they don't do that. Look, cops. In general, there's something strange about cops.
When they're not raiding gay bars when they're off duty.
Cops are, anyone who wants to go into a profession where you carry a pistol, we may need them, but you've got to find strange people to do this kind of job. You've got to find people with a streak of violence because you don't carry these weapons unless you're prepared to use them. And to want to use them, well, I wouldn't want to do it, would you?
Police work?
Yeah.
No.
Would you want? I mean, I'm not talking about police work. I'm talking about the kind of work that requires carrying a pistol.
No,
a street cop.
No, I wouldn't want to do it. I don't have a. I've never had a pistol. I've never had any desire to have one. My brother lives in Houston. He got a pistol once because he was afraid that this was in the 1960s, and he was afraid of black rioting reaching his lily-white neighborhood. After a while, when he had two kids, he was afraid that one of the kids might find the gun. So he took the gun to the Buffalo Bayou and tossed it in the water. He just didn't want to have it around the house, and I don't blame him. You also have quite a bit to say about race relations in Houston, too, because one of the victims is a Vietnamese man.
Yeah, that's an interesting setup there. There's a huge foreign community moved into Houston in the last 10 years, particularly Vietnamese and a lot of other Asians, and they're very industrious, very dedicated and ambitious, and there's a lot of resentment among native-born Texans and any state, I think. When I was out in Houston in the late 80s, the charge against the Vietnamese was that they had taken over the shrimp industry on the Gulf. They worked too hard, people said. We can't keep up with them. You know, we don't want to work 70 or 80 hours a week. And the Vietnamese did and made enormous sacrifices. And when they took over a store, a 7-Eleven or a Circle K, the whole family worked in there. And the service was better. And the store was open more hours. And Caucasian families complained. These guys are ruining our livelihood. They work too hard. It's a real problem. I hear it in California, too. I hear people complaining up at the University of California at Berkeley that the Japanese students study too hard. They're too smart. I don't know how to cope with that one.
It happens here, too. You know, yeah. There's the Coalition of Blacks has been boycotting a series of Korean grocery stores in Brooklyn.
Yes. What happened with that? I was in New York in May when the mayor was trying to calm that one down.
It's been very complicated. The last major thing to develop was the discovery of firebombs that didn't go off on the roof of this building. That was some weeks ago. There were three stores involved. One, they settled because they sold. The people involved sold to another Korean family, but they were different Koreans.
I
believe technically the two on Church Avenue are still being struck, but now the courts have intervened and they keep the demonstrators back 100 feet or something from the stores, so people can't be intimidated when they go in.
The problem of race relations is going to be with us till the end of time. It's naive to think you can solve it. You can put a damper on it for a while, but anybody who's different from you, you're going to look at with suspicion.
Well, the people, the blacks, or the ones involved in the protests in these neighborhoods, are looking for things in order to challenge the Koreans. It's philosophical, however. They simply are, I guess, jealous. They just don't want these outsiders, these industrious outsiders in the neighborhood. There's no way to describe it other than that.
As human beings, we're always looking for scapegoats. We're always saying, groups are saying, hey, we haven't got what everyone else has got, so why? It certainly can't be our fault. It's got to be the fault of some other group who's somehow weaseled it out of us, whatever that it is that we should have. And I don't see it ending.
Well, Clifford, I kind of hate to bring this up, but to go back to the criminal justice system, you yourself, of course, are no stranger to it because of your own dilemma many years ago involving the Howard Hughes situation. As one caught up in that yourself, your research into Daddy's Girl and the leftover research for trial, were there any similarities at all?
No, that was such an unusual incident in my life, and I think in the life of the news media. There's nothing that's happened since except for the phony Hitler diaries that's been similar. And the experience that I've had in the criminal justice system in the last 4 or 5 years, covering murder trials as an investigative reporter, just doesn't bear any relationship to what I went through then. Maybe I know my way around a little better, and I understand the nature of the criminal justice system because I was enmeshed in it. But I wasn't a murderer.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't have anything to do with that.
Yeah, that should be pointed out. That was a hoax and a fraud and a really kind of a weird situation. But it's true. When you're talking about murder, I mean, that's really different. In effect, well, of course, it was a criminal case involving you. It wasn't.
Oh, it was criminal. I didn't think it wasn't so terrible. It was just a literary hoax, and the temper of the Nixon administration at the time was such that they threw the book at me, and I went to prison. And indeed, I met murderers in prison. And I have to tell you that I remember the first guy I met was a man named Joey. I won't give you his last name. He might be around today. He started throwing a football back and forth with me one day at Danbury Prison, and we became friendly. And a young guy in his late 20s, and I said, what are you in here for? And he said, oh, some minor thing. And indeed, it turned out to be a minor, not a tax charge, but something similar, extortion. And then later, I was speaking to other people, they said, Yeah, Joey's a hitman for the mob back in Brooklyn. I said, you got to be kidding. He's a nice guy. And they said, why shouldn't a hitman be a nice guy when he isn't doing his job? You just don't want to be the fella he gets angry at, or he's told to get angry at. So I learned a lesson that way. I mean, I never got to know him intimately. I didn't care to.
I think Joey was found last week in the trunk of a car on the Bay Parkway.
As long as I don't find him when I leave the studio today, waiting outside for me.
You know, I was talking to Howard Fast last week. He has a new book out called Being Red, and in 1950 he was sent to prison. And he said, I asked him how he felt about it after all these years. He said, every writer should be sent to
every
prison.
Every writer should go to prison. You know, I met Howard Fast last week at the Literary Guild party. My new book is a Literary Guild selection, and so is Howard Fast. And I had never met him. But when I was a kid, Howard Fast was a very important person in my life because I read his early books, The Unvanquished, Freedom Road, Spartacus, and he was left-wing, a communist, perhaps.
He was. He never hit it.
And I was a left-wing kid who had grown up in Manhattan and flirting with the Communist Party at the time, as most of us were. And he came up to Cornell to lecture while I was there. I was thrilled to listen to him and whatnot. And then I met him at the Literary Guild party in the flesh. That was wonderful. I went up to him and told him right away that he had touched me by his work when I was a very young man. And he was moved by that, too. He said, gee, you know, writers can never hear enough of that. That's what you want as a writer, to be able to move somebody else. And he did that to me.
What I like about Howard is his more a sense of morality. He brings that to his work and to his presence. When he was a communist, he never hit it. He had a weekly column in the Daily Worker. He said whenever he had a party, he said there were probably more FBI people in his parties at his house on Central Park West than invited guests. His phone was tapped. He was followed. They copied articles he wrote. He said they didn't have to copy articles. He said I would have given them carbons. But he never hit it because he always believed that the Communist Party sought justice. Now, obviously, he was naive in many respects when he insisted that the Communist Party here did not follow the communist line in the Soviet Union. Well, we all know it did. But at one point, he began to realize this was true, and he broke with the Communist Party and never went back to it. And he's still a leftist. He ran under, I think, the Social Labor Party for Congress in the Bronx and got 2,000 votes and had a lot of fun.
He should have been elected. Anyone who's been through an experience like that where they have been convinced of a lie by themselves and by friends and by what they've read, and then realizes afterwards that it was a lie, that person is more knowledgeable than the common run-of-the-mill politician who still believes the lies that he or she tells to us when they're running for office. I'm sorry Howard Fast wasn't elected to something.
Have you ever written about your prison days?
I kept a journal, and Playboy excerpted it some years ago in a rather long excerpt which won the award for the best Playboy article of the year. But I have never written at length about it. I think in a few years I'm going to publish a collection of my nonfiction pieces called Misadventures. Include my prison experience and other strange things that have happened to me in my life. But so far, no, I have not.
Howard Fast has. I mean, he's mined it. He's milked it. He's put it in at least two or three novels, and including his last novel, which was called The Pledge. And, of course, in his new nonfiction book, he has it in there, too. So it's he's a believer that you mine the things that happen to you, and you turn them into your fiction.
Well, in part you do. I've used many, many things that have happened to me in my novels, but not in trial, no. Except for the subplot, if you will. The character in trial is a lawyer, which I'm not, but he's married, which I am and have been, and his marriage doesn't work out, and that has happened to me more than once. and that is an important part of the book. Because he's married to a woman who's whose consciousness is growing as a result of the feminist movement. She's an anchor woman for a Houston TV station. And they split up during the course of the book, and Warren, the hero, meets a young court reporter. Actually, she's a few years older than he is. But he meets her in the course of the trials and gets involved with her. And that kind of triangle situation, I've been through it. I'm sure many people have. And I used it in my book.
And it should be noted that Warren makes the right decision at the end.
Let us hope so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the craft of writing, how you go about putting words on paper. This is a subject that fascinates me, being an erstwhile writer myself. I'm taking on Monday nights, I go to a writer's workshop. You know, we exchange short stories and talk about them in class. You know, it's something that I did 30 years ago when I was in college. You know, but somehow I felt I wanted to be able to look at a story and construct it and take it apart and analyze it.
It's never too late to go crazy, though. And you need to be a little crazy, I think, to be a writer.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, to dream up these situations that occur in novels, you have to have a bizarre imagination. You have to plumb the depths of your own possibilities, for one thing. I've always thought that that's the key to fiction, is you figure, what am I capable of under stress? You know, what would I do to achieve certain things and put into a certain situation, a life or death situation, a situation of peril? How far could I go? And that is the stuff of fiction, because most of us don't live on the edge. We live in a very contained, safe little world. It's much easier to live that way. But part of us, probably the primitive part of us, yearns to be on the edge of our personalities, to test the edge of the envelope, as the flyboys say. And I think that's what writers do a lot. They push out the edges of the envelope and work out their problems in fiction, if they're good writers.
That's interesting. And yet, trying to be a writer myself, an amateur. Oh, I did publish one book, which was a novel in 1988. St. Martin's.
So you're not an amateur at all.
No, but I am. It was an amateur work that I probably should not have published. And I look at it now and I said, "Geez, I could do better than that."
What was it called?
It's called the H.L. Mencken Murder Case. And it was set in 1948 in New York in Baltimore. And Mencken, that was the year Mencken had his stroke that ended his career. And I had him solving both a literary crime that turns into a murder. And it should have been redone, but it was a first effort. But I'd worked on it for a long time. I have a full-time job here at CBS, so I have to do it on nights and weekends, and it can be very draining. But the thing that I notice is that, in trying to do this, that you do it all by yourself. When I come to work here, I have a deadline. I have deadlines to meet. I have headlines to write. I have reporters to talk to. And I have appointments with people like yourself. And it's very, very specific. And then I get a paycheck every Thursday. But I sit at home and try to write. There's nobody who tells me to do it.
Yeah.
I just wonder about the mentality of someone who is so masochistic that he can go in front of a computer screen and do that.
I told you this. It requires a certain craziness, a little lunacy. It's a lonely profession. It's tough. And I certainly welcome those kinds of novels that require some research, where I have to go out into the world, as it were. The courtroom novel, like Trial, and the one I'm doing now, it's a perfect combination, because from time to time, I've got to talk to these people, lawyers, judges. I've got to sit in court and listen to what's going on and absorb the atmosphere, hang out in the police station, so that it's not so lonely. The lonely part is the writing of it. But I have found that the writing of a book takes much less time than the thinking about the book before you sit down to write, and the rewriting. And I love to rewrite. I find that one of the great pleasures, you know, because that's pure exercise of craft and your editorial sensibilities, which are those of a shaper. You know, you finish the first draft of a book, and more often than not, it's messy. It's got jagged edges. It's got silly digressions. It's too long. It's too short. This character is weak. That character is an idiot. And you must, then you really have to think and work. And I love that. And working with a computer has made it easier and faster to do that kind of work. I love my computer. we're pals.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've had a love affair with mine now for about 5 years. And I used to be a cigarette smoker. And the first thing I would do in the morning was pick up my cigarette. And the last thing would be to stuff it out.
Me too.
Now it's the computer. The first thing when I get up in the morning, I turn on my computer and look at my calendar. And the last thing I do when I go to bed at night is shut off that computer.
And you can't smoke when you shouldn't smoke anyway while you're working at your computer. It's not good for it.
No. I allow no cigarette smoking on my computer. But you seem like an unlikely guy to be a successful writer. I mean, you're so extroverted and outgoing. You kind of picture writers as just being so consumed and isolated.
Well, I'm extroverted in a sense. I'm here in New York. It's exciting for me. It's my hometown. I was born and brought up here. Now I live in the mountains of Mexico. And sometimes for a week or two on end, I don't speak to anybody except my wife. And so when I get up to New York, I'm turned on. I love it.
So you go stir crazy a little bit, huh?
No, I don't go stir crazy. I also love the isolation down there, the quiet. I tend my garden. I write my books. I ride down there in the desert, horseback riding. And I leave periodically to get a taste of not civilization so much as the energy of contemporary society. Because Mexico, where I live, it's not contemporary. It's an old, old culture. And it's nourishing down there.
Well, Clifford, we're almost out of time. Just to go back to the writing a little bit, which is a subject that has fascinated me for so many years. I've been the book editor at CBS for almost 20 years now. When you write something, are you sure that this is what you want, or do you need to get an editor's point of view, or how does this work exactly?
I'm pretty sure it's what I want. I don't need an editor's point of view. When I finish, I want an editor and a few people who I trust and love. I want them to read it and give me some input, because I know that work, there's always something more to be done. Alexandre Dumas said novels are never finished, they're just abandoned. And it's true, at a certain point,
like psychotherapy,
you can't go on, right? You can't go on anymore. But 2 or 3 years later, if you picked up that manuscript again, you could certainly improve it, and you would certainly change it, because you would be a different person. So that I need other people, but I don't need them when I'm working. Then I want to be left alone. I don't want to be kibitzed, and I couldn't be in a profession where I had anyone telling me what to do.
Well, in Trial, you have so many factual situations here. Did you run this by an attorney or anything?
Two attorneys. One in Houston, who read it once, and a good friend of mine in New York, a lawyer named Maurice Nesson, who read it several times during the course of various drafts and rewrites, and helped me a lot.
Well, I noticed that the judge did not seem to charge the jury. Isn't that a normal in this book?
The judge charges the jury.
But he didn't seem to do it. After the final summations, I think the judge nodded to the bailiff, who then took the jury out.
You must have been skimming, or it was late at night when you were reading that part. The judge charges the jury briefly in trial. In Texas, I think.
Before the summations?
You know, I don't really remember.
Because it wasn't after the summations.
It's not the way it's done in New York. Whatever way it's done in New York, it's done the opposite in Texas, because my lawyer did comment on it.
No, I'm sure you're absolutely accurate on the thing. It's just something that I wondered about.
Yeah, well, and now I have to find out how the judge charges a jury in Florida, because I'm writing about a murder.
What's going to be
there.
The theme?
I'm writing a book called Unusual Punishment, about a prosecutor who, 10 years after he sends a man to death row, decides that the fellow is innocent and comes back to defend him.
Thanks a lot.
Well, it isn't easy.
Oh, that's an intriguing.
It isn't easy.
That's an intriguing concept. I guess you're never. It's really not possible to run out of ideas, is it? And not in our lifetime.
No, I have an idea file that's bulging. I will never live long enough to write 1/10 of the ideas in my idea file. You don't run out of ideas And you don't run out of characters, but it's hard to find something that's satisfying, that you feel is really worth dedicating 2 years of your life to, because that's about what it takes. Mm-hmm. You have to be sure, or at least you have to believe before you start, that this is a worthwhile project. You can't just say, I'm going to make money out of it. At least I can't, because I wouldn't be able to sustain the level of energy for 2 years. And you have to believe that it's something that the reader will enjoy, because no matter how serious a writer you are, you better remember that you're an entertainer, too, that you're there to capture people.
Yeah, when the bottom line is this, isn't it? Storytelling.
That's right. Gather around the campfire and listen to me, because I'm going to tell you a terrific story. And then at some point you say, now go back to bed and tomorrow we'll meet here again. That's the end of a chapter.
what a way to express it. Trial, and this is a wonderful story to trial, by Clifford Irving. Thank you, Clifford.
Good to talk to you, man.
Thank you so much.